And he put Adam in the garden, and Adam and Eve are mankind. Probably touch on that a bit too. But he put them in the garden, and then very significantly, he wanted to water the garden, of course, but the Garden of Eden was built on a mountain. Just jot down in your notes the word mountain. I don't know how you take notes. Don't know if anybody's ever told you how to take notes, because we all take notes our own way anyway. When I want to research something, I put it down separately in my notes. I might put a circle around it, but I put a question mark after it. And that means I want to know more about it. When I go back over my notes, and I'll pull that out, and I'll do a whole thing on that one thing. But when you look at mountain, mountain is one of the important symbols of the Bible. Mountains stand for kingdoms, high places. Oh, there's a lot about mountains. Don't get me into that. But Eden was planted on a mountain. And in the midst of it, there was a stream, the headwaters of a stream. And the first thing for that headwater was that it should water the garden. That river primarily was concerned to maintain the beauty of the garden by providing it with water. Water is another word you need to research. That's another one you need to put down with a question mark. It's a good thing to get a lot of these things researched, and then you start to build up in the library of your mind a whole context of understanding, so that when you read mountain, you say, aha. You read water, you say, oh-ho. You read tree, and you say, ah. And you read rock, and you say, Because remember how God teaches us. He does it by analogy, mainly from creation. Remember Romans 1:20. The invisible things of God are clearly seen by the things that are made, even his eternal power and Godhead. God has written himself into creation. So that if you want to understand God, you have to do it analogically. Now, don't get religious about God and say, let me see if I can. God gave you a head, and he gave you eyes, and he gave you his those are his trees out there. That's his air. Find out about air. That's important. It keeps you alive, oxygen. Find out about wind. Wind is very important. Find out about storms. They're very significant. Earthquakes, full of meaning. A lot of Christian people are so spiritual, they're blind to God in nature and providence. They miss God. I see God everywhere. God's everywhere. It's God's world, God's creation. God's in every atom. God is personally involved in every atom. God's busy keeping the atoms of my earlobe. He's personally overseeing my earlobe. Now, when you become so aware of God that he's in everything, even the wickedness of man is a demonstration of the obverse of God. You can even, as you observe sin around you, you can see by contrast that that's a violation of God. What we've done, without becoming an extreme ecologist, and joining what you call the greenies, is it? All extreme positions are overextensions of something that is valid. There is an ecological reality that Christians have been blind to. And Christians, unfortunately, have many times had a low evaluation of the things that are made, with the result that Christians have exploited them because they don't see them as a domain that God has given us to keep and to guard. And there's a balance in it. God gave us rule over the animal. We're to kill enough to eat. But we are to guard them. We are to rule them wisely. Now, even nature itself has a system of weeding out undesirables. And they say that nature is red in hoof and claw. But there is a system in nature that adjusts itself. And where man has violated that, when man rapes a mountainside and takes all its timber, he not only destroys its beauty, but he then violates its drainage system. So we have entire parts of the world today that are becoming desert, because man has not been a responsible carer of the garden. Now you can bring that right into the realm of the spirit. If you don't take care of your spiritual garden, it'll get full of weeds. That's why you constantly got to be putting to death the deeds of the body. What are you doing? You're weeding your garden. If you don't weed your garden, the weeds will choke out your holiness. You become carnal. All right, let's get to the river. The river, rivers, that's another one of the question marks. Once you get onto this principle, you have your notebook full of question marks. What are you doing? You're setting up your lifelong task of finding out what God has said. And at 76, I am just as vigorously pursuing it as I did 60 years ago. It's a lifelong path. But it becomes your joy. It becomes your joy. And you build your library in terms of your research. You start to build your resources. If you can get the excitement of what the future holds for you in terms of just studying the Word, it will make the labors that God gives you much more delightful. What is a river? Well, a river is probably one of the most eloquent metaphors that we have in the Bible. Rivers stand for communication, transportation, colonization, civilization, agriculture, life. Think of 100 years ago. No automobile. No 747. One of the great international industries 100 years ago was the shipping industry. And the rivers are still important. If they're not as important for transportation and communication as they once were, they're still important because they are the arteries of continents. Now, once you start to research rivers, that opens a whole dimension. Especially when you know, as you're studying rivers, God is talking to me. Now, the unregenerate man, he's just studying it geographically and scientifically. But you got that added excitement because you start to hear God saying things to you about rivers spiritually. In other days, before our more sophisticated forms of communication, people built their homes and built their towns and built their farms along rivers. They got their mail by the monthly boat or whatever. Aunt Susie came to visit them on the boat. They got communication. They got transportation. They probably ran irrigation conduit from the river to their soil to provide food to keep them alive. The river was pretty important. Still very important. Still very important. But the Bible probably gives us the major meaning of a river, and that's life. Out of your innermost being shall flow rivers. Living water. Living water. Living. That's the active word. Living water. Salvation is referred to as the wells of salvation. Water. Or wota. Our Canadian harsh sounds must grate on your ears. Water. All right. Colonization. Now, you say, well, what's colonization? Well, if you don't have a river flowing, nobody is going to build a colony. Where do congregations congregate? Around water. You're going into the work of the Lord, you better provide water. Water is one of the most rich metaphors in the Bible. Because it's one of the metaphors that applies equally to the Word and the Spirit. Now, if you are going to hopefully gather a church, what is the prior essential? Water. Water. That means that you must be a Word Spirit person who will provide them with what they want, and want enough they realize they can't be without, so you become a water source. A real servant of God is a water source. I learned early in my service for God that if I provided the people with the Word and the Spirit, I provided them with water, they'd be there. And that's my total attraction. I don't pull rabbits out of hats. I don't do vaudeville stunts. My whole attraction is I provide, hopefully, people with the water of the Word and the water of the anointing. All right, we've talked about rivers, but what is significant about the river in the Garden of Eden? And what is significant about it dividing into four? So, another question mark. Four, question mark. See, I've given you already several leads that'll take you a few hours of research and be a delight to you. The more question marks you have, the more things you've got to look up. I've got pages of question marks. I'll have them after I die. They'll be in my study. I'll not get around to them. I remember when I was young, I thought, well, when I'm old, I'll know everything. But now I'm like Socrates. Socrates said near the end of his life, one thing only I know, and that is I know nothing. Relatively. Doesn't mean Socrates was an nincompoop. It just meant that Socrates was so aware of the vast scope of available knowledge that relatively he knew nothing. That's one of the reasons I believe in progress after death. All right? Four. What is four? Well, Bible talks about, I'll give you some hints. Bible talks about the four winds of heaven. It also speaks about the four corners of the earth. It also talks about the four living creatures. Four is the number of the earth. One is the number of God, two is the number of fellowship, three is the number of manifestation, four is the number of the earth. Five is the number of grace, six is the number of man, seven is the number of completion, eight is the number of a new beginning. Oh, numbers, question mark. That takes you into the whole area of what is called biblical geometria, where you study numbers in the Bible. You think God just put numbers in there higgledy-piggledy? No. Immediately you can think of numbers that are important. Seven? Oh, how important is seven? 12. Multiples of 12. Multiples of seven. 5. 1,000. Numbers. Exciting thing. You can prepare a series of lectures, it'll take you 6 months on numbers. Numbers are all, that's why the whole issue about the millennium, if you literalize it in a symbolic book, you've missed the whole purpose of it. 1,000 years is not literally 1,000 years, because 1,000 in the Bible is the number of indefiniteness. Just means a big number that might be anything, really. Everything is symbolic. If you're a literalist, you're handicapped, because everything is symbolic. Words are symbolic. Let's assume you'd never seen a glass or a gloss. You'd not ever seen one before, okay? You never saw a glass. I said, do you have a glass? So what's a glass? You don't know what a glass is. Oh. So a little later on, you find the glass, and you go to the person and say, now, this is a glass. Oh, that's a glass. Now, glass becomes a symbol of this. The word is not the thing. The word points to the thing. So forever now, I've got an association in my mind, and because I can't go around carrying a bunch of tumblers or glosses, I just carry around a word in my vocabulary. That takes care of glasses, short glasses, tall glasses, wide glasses, thin glasses, all kinds of glasses. The word. It's a symbol. Never saw a horse, and I say to you, know there any horses running? What's a horse? The word doesn't do you a bit of good until you know what it goes with. So our whole language is symbolic. Everything is analogical. Once you start to understand that, then you become interested in the analogy. Now this river wants to flow out of the Garden of Eden, out of the Garden of Eden, remember. Because I'm going to talk to you about three sources in these mornings. It flows out of the Garden of Eden in four directions. North, east, west, south. What does that say to it? It says that somehow the Garden of Eden is the source of light for the world. Remember what we're talking about, God's world purpose. My good friend David Chilton, in his book on Paradise Restored, says, Eden as the source of water was thus the source of blessing for the world, providing the basis for life, health, and prosperity to all God's creatures. For this reason, water becomes an important symbol in Scripture for the blessings of salvation. Now, another friend of mine, Dr. Jim Jordan, has done a recent work in which he upgraded my original diagram and put it in the front of his book. I had occasion to tell him I was using it at lunch one day and said that was fine, so I don't have a copyright on it, but I have permission. Can you take that? You have to take the... I'm just hoping this will help you see something of what I'm saying. Reception isn't too good. Ah, we're getting there. Well, that's good enough. Now, this is a stylized drawing. Mine isn't nearly as suggestive as this. The one I originally did didn't have all this stylization and these crosses in here, which is fine. But it gives you the idea. If you get this into your mind, it will give you a concept of God's world and His intention for the world in redemption. This is God's world. And that God originally intended, before the fall, God intended that His man, Adam, here in this special garden would develop a God kind of life which would then be imported on the four salvific rivers that would take the quality of Edenic life to the entire earth so that the entire earth would become a Garden of Eden. I said, boy, that's pretty dramatic, isn't it? Well, why would God want the beautiful garden just for two of His creatures? Why wouldn't He want it for them all? Well, He did want it for them all. But He wanted it for them all. I hope you'll understand this. He wanted it for them all in the process of learning, so that they would learn in their unfallenness. Learn in their unfallenness. Because Adam wasn't made like God. He was in the image of God, but he doesn't have omniscience. He's not an omni person. He's a dependent person. Adam, when he was created with the complete human capacity to know God, but know Him as a creature. Let me once and for all put the kiss of death on any idea that we're ever going to be God. That's a foolish idea that thoughtless people pick up. We're going to ultimately be in the likeness of Jesus, God's incarnate Son. We're going to have bodies under like unto His glorious body. We're going to have a glorified humanity, not an assumed deity. Now, God's intention, therefore, was to fill the earth with the life of the Garden of Eden. Now, as we go on to deal with the land and the kingdom of God, we're going to see that as God's purposes unfold down through history, He's never abandoned the original pattern. Ideally, the Church of God in Toowoomba, unfortunately, it's all splintered. I looked at the church page this weekend again. I call it the scandal sheet. I think it is the most depressing demonstration of the scandal of our disunity. Just depresses me to look at the church page. And the low motivation, the low attractiveness that they try to project. You know, we are the friendly church. All the other churches are unfriendly. It makes a juvenile statement about our immaturity. Now, if the redeemed community in Toowoomba was the way it should be and it was one, it would be the river that would water the garden. This is the garden city. That's ideal. You need a spiritual river here to water the garden city. Now, because that is not now attainable, then the church of which we are a part here needs to try to be to the degree it can without all of the others that should be in it. Needs to try to fulfill the Edenic pattern. That is God's pattern. Don't make substitutes for it. That's God's pattern. We ought to be constantly nagging away at the scandal of our division. Just nagging away at them. So, we've talked about symbols now. We've talked about the significance of rivers and significance of the number four. And what we have said is that the garden culture is to become universal. Do you understand what I'm saying? How many understand what I've said up until now? Okay. Does it mean anything to you, or am I talking through my ears? The garden culture. A culture is a form of life. Not just a form of concept, a form of life. That's why community, Christian community, is so vigorously fought by Christians who are satisfied with a concept but not a reality. The world is not waiting for better ideas, it's waiting for better models. Let me read you a few excerpts that I feel are important. One of the great Dutch theologians, a man by the name of Bavinck, from whom I received a lot of help, he says, the image of God, so to speak, had to be spread to the ends of the earth and had to be impressed on all the works of men's hands. Man had to cultivate the earth so that it would more and more become a revelation of God's attributes. A British writer by the name of Ellison says, the obvious inference is that Adam was so to carry out his work in the garden that he and his family would gradually extend it until it had embraced the whole world. Now, I'm quoting these because I don't want you to think that I have embraced something that's not understood. Let me read you another one. Dr. Fairbairn. And if you are thinking of building a library, let me suggest to you that an absolutely essential book to understand typology, is Fairbairn's book on typology. It's not easy to secure, but if you can secure it, it's just full of suggestions. Just, it's rich. Dr. Fairbairn was a Scotsman who pastored the same church for over 50 years and probably never traveled more than 2 miles from his home his whole life. Those were back in the last century, in the days when you were born, raised, and died in the same house, and you had a lot of time for quality research. We don't have time for research now. We're too busy riding cars and bicycles and airplanes and scooting around this way and that way. We don't have, we've screwed up our time factor. All right, let me read from it. From the outset, the earth, in its entire extent and compass, was given for the domain and heritage of man. Told you we'd get around to that again. Why don't I just pause and say it now? This earth was not made for angels. This earth was not made for demons. Let me say this. This earth was not made for wicked men. This earth is structured for righteous mankind. Peter said that we, according to promise, look for new heavens and new earth wherein dwelleth righteousness. You personally, physically, constitutionally, neurologically, you were not structured for sin. Sin is a violation of the structure of your being. You're not made for it. That's why it's so averse. That's why it is so disturbing. There's another dis. Watch your use of dis. Every time you say dis something, think about it. Ah, there's that devil again. I had an appointment and somebody screwed it up and now I'm disappointed. See, become aware of this. Once in a while, be aware of that, too. It's all right. I'm this and that, you know. You looked at me rather strangely. I'm all right. I got a little mischief in me. All right. Now, I'll tell you why this is important. And God makes it important in the book of Hebrews. He said that when Jesus came, he did not lay hold upon the seed of angels. Jesus didn't come in an angelic form. It wouldn't have been any good to us. He laid hold upon the seed of Abraham. Became a man. Why? Because God's whole purpose for this earth is man. God will... Are you listening now? God will not be satisfied until this earth is under the dominion of his creature, man, because that's what he put him here for originally. Don't go around with your head down as though you're an outsider. This is your world. These wicked people that are screwing it up are imposters. That's why we've got to get them off. Got to get these Canaanites out. They're screwing up the land. We have to get righteousness back. This earth is made for righteousness. If you know that, then you won't at least mentally concede the right of wicked men. We've lost by default. These political shysters that are making merchandise out of government, they're Canaanites. Our job is to oust them and put righteousness in there. That's why the psalmist said, God, break their teeth. Some say, oh, that isn't Christian. Well, if you believe in the inspiration of the scriptures, then the psalmist was praying the mind of God in his inspired prayer. He said, break the teeth of wicked men. What's hell for? Hell is to deal with the garbage of the universe. The garbage can of the universe. All right. Man was placed in paradise as his proper home. I like that choice of words. Man was placed in paradise. What is our proper home? Weeds in the garden? Snakes that bite us? Spiders that send us to heaven ahead of time? God intended for us to live in a Garden of Eden. He was placed in paradise as his proper home. There he had the throne of his kingdom, but not that he might be pent up within that narrow region. Rather, that he might from that, as the seat of his empire and the center of his operations, go forth upon the world around and bring it under his sway. His calling was to multiply and replenish the earth and subdue it, so that it might become to its utmost bounds and extended in people's paradise. Isn't that beautiful? That's God's intention. Let me quote Chilton again. Adam was created a king. He was to subdue the earth and have dominion over it. His kingship, however, was not absolute. Adam was a subordinate king, a king under God. He was a king only because God had created him as such and ordered him to rule. God's plan was for his image to rule the world under his laws and oversight. As long as Adam was faithful to his commission, he was able to have dominion over the earth. Psalm 115:16 is another delightful insight. The heaven, even the heavens, are the Lord's, but the earth hath he given to the children of men. Isn't that clear? The Bible talks about heaven, thy dwelling place. What is earth? My dwelling place. And how am I to furnish my dwelling place? Like he furnishes his dwelling place. So the more I know about heaven, the more I know what I'm to make earth. And one of the first things that we have is order. So it's very important. Paul said about the Colossians, he said, I am with you, beholding and rejoicing in your order. Paul, writing to the Corinthians, said, let everything be done. How? Decently and in order. Order is the redemption of disorder. Let me just give you one more quote and then we'll stop for 5 minutes. This is Meredith Klein. He said, thus God sent them into the world on their mission as his anointed servants with a royal mandate to exercise dominion over the earth in his name. They were to fill the earth with their royal kind, and they were to bring the earth under their rule. Through human procreation and by the various labors of their royal rule, they were to produce a royal human race, a universal ruling committee. Isn't that beautiful? Now, you say, why are you belaboring us with this? Because I want to expand your head. I want you to see that no matter how seemingly uneventful and unimportant is your task, that it is part of a vast symphony of divine intention. And that you laboring somewhere obscure, unsung, unseen, unheralded, are playing your part. I often think of my body, especially when it hurts. But sometimes when I think of my body, I get scared. And I realize the intricacies of my body. My wife's a registered nurse. I haven't studied anatomy, but I know enough about it because of my own involvements with my anatomy to know that it is a series of very complex parts. And it all interrelates. My nervous system with my blood system, the brain, the impulses. And I think, Lord, I'm scared to move. You know, I may upset something. Now, scientists are equally impressed. Doctors are impressed with the marvelous machinery of the body. Then we're faced with the mystery of what keeps it going. When I think about my body sometimes, I realize that every second of my life, I'm here by the grace of God. God's keeping me going. Now, I got cells in my body that I don't know about, but if I didn't have them, the rest of my body wouldn't function normally. So every part of my body, the parts that are obscure, are integral parts of the whole. And what I'm doing to you this morning is trying to condition you to understand that the little task that you embrace is really not that little. It is important to the whole. All right, let's take 5 minutes. That'd be fine. Sorry if my disability is causing you discomfort. You do the best you can with that, will you? Get around to deal with all of this in depth, but it's my desire to point out to you that the original intention of God, as we replace the first diagram with this one, that God's original intention has not changed. It has gone through this process. And the featured person in each of these areas is Adam, Moses, and Christ. The same principle is involved throughout. That just as Adam was to export on the four rivers to the entire earth, the knowledge and culture of the garden. So Israel under Moses was to do the same, and now we under Christ are to do the same. We're to go into all the world. Now let me just point something out to you here. In Joel 2:3, a fire consumes before them and behind them a flame burns. Here's the phrase I want you to get. The land is like the Garden of Eden before them, but a desolate wilderness behind them, and nothing at all escapes them. The land, the second feature, is like the Garden of Eden. Now, let's look at number three, the kingdom of God in terms of Eden. Isaiah 51:3. This is prophetic of Messiah's day and the land of the new covenant. Isaiah 51:3, indeed the Lord will comfort Zion. He will comfort all her waste places, and her wilderness he will make like Eden, and her desert like the garden of the Lord. Joy and gladness will be found in her, thanksgiving and sound of melody. Now, isn't it interesting that where you and I live in the kingdom land, that God, through the scriptures, goes back to the Garden of Eden to give us an analogy, something that we can relate to as to what we're to be like. So the more we can find out about the Garden of Eden, the more we can spin off into God's subsequent intentions through Israel and through us. Ezekiel chapter 36, verse 33-36. Thus says the Lord God, on the day that I cleanse you from all your iniquities, I will cause the cities to be inhabited, and the waste places will be rebuilt. That's all symbolic, of course. And the desolate land will be cultivated instead of being a desolation in the sight of everyone who passed by. And they will say, this desolate land has become like the Garden of Eden. Isn't that interesting? God's kind of stubborn, isn't he? He said, this garden is my intention. I don't care how long it takes. It's going to be in the end like it is in the beginning. Right. That's the introduction. Now, for the rest of our time this morning, let's start in on what I call the Gospel of the Garden. The Gospel of the Garden. And we're talking, of course, of how we see the gospel coming to us in God's original intention for the garden. Now, when we're talking about the gospel of the garden, and indeed the gospel of the land, and eventually the gospel of the kingdom, we're speaking about those essentials in the message that are continuous, that are the very fiber of God's good news. It will take on different aspects, but fundamentally there's something the same about God's approach to mankind in every age. We are living in the best of the three, especially if we consider the Garden of Eden post-fall. Now, if we're talking about the Garden of Eden before the fall, of course, we have no way of making that comparison because, again, we can only imagine, by analogy, what it must have been like for the very short time that Adam and Eve lived unfallen. We have reason to believe it was very, very short. In fact, just a matter of hours. But we really have no way, except analogically, and in a sort of a negative way. Well, what was Adam like? Well, he was different from me to the degree that sin made me different from him. Now, if you can work that out, you have some idea. He was different from me physically to the degree that he had no physical flaws or hereditary ailments. He was different to me intellectually in that all the information he was receiving from God was pure and unsullied by the dis factor. He was different to me spiritually because his spirit had no sin factor in it and there responded perfectly to God. That's about as far as I can go. So pre-fall Adam is in some ways, a picture of redeemed man, ultimately, with some added good features. The first one being that Adam was on probation, and we're not. All right, the first thing that I want to say that is basic to all gospel, whether it's the gospel of the garden, gospel of the land, or the gospel of the kingdom, is God's sovereignty. That's point number one, God's sovereignty. I would commend to you in your devotions and in your studies, however far you go, if you sophisticate your studies beyond this and go on to other levels of academic and theological training, whatever, I commend to you a constant searching in the Scriptures for the revelation that God has made of Himself. I would say that one of the great problems with a lot of Christianity today, especially charismatic, is that it has conceived its own view of what God is like. That's very dangerous and comes close to idolatry. Idolatry is really man establishing his concept of God and projecting it into Godhead. He understands that God somehow is supposed to be omniscient, omnipotent, omnipresent, all the omnis. He understands that. But because he doesn't receive the revelation of God from God, then in his fallenness, he takes his idea of God and he omnis it. I may coin a word. He pushes it into the infinity that somehow he knows God has. Now, all ideas of infinity are not that perfect, because the Greeks, when you study Greek mythology, the Greek gods were very human. They were immoral, they were bad, they were... Well, it really proves my principle, I guess. The Greeks took themselves and the things that they were permitted themselves, and they put them in their gods, and then they worshiped themselves. And you say, why are you telling us this? Because in some ways we are capable of doing that in a fringe way. Now, I hear charismatics talking about God, and especially Jesus. And I just have to say right up front, without being judgmental about it, it's not the Jesus or God of the Bible I hear them talking about. It's the Jesus they'd like to believe in. Sloppy, effeminate, icky. The language they use about him indicates to me that they don't really know him from the Bible. He is a projection of their best desires. They start out by saying, well, I sure hope God's like this. I think he probably is. I'm sure he is. And then they make God that. That's idolatry. That's idolatry. Now, let me say this to you. And I'm not, I'm not trying to make proud scholars of you. That's never... The greatest scholars I know are the humblest men. Because once you get into the area of scholarship, you have a profound appreciation for your own stupidity. What I'm talking to you about is medicine for your soul. I'm saying you cannot afford, for the sake of your own Christian maturity, you cannot afford to have a low view of God. You need to know what is meant by holiness. Not holiness just behaviorally. I'm talking about holiness essentially. Be holy because I am holy. What's that mean? You need to understand righteousness. You need to understand omnipotence, all the omni, from God's standpoint. You need to understand God's priority. What do I mean by God's priority? Well, He was here before we were. Before the hills were brought forth, thou art. Oh. So if in the beginning was God, then everything we have comes from God, and we'd be wise to consult God because He was here before everything. And He planted everything perfect in the beginning, and we need to go back and look at it because that's where we're heading. All right? Let me give you a couple of scriptures here. Hebrews 1, 1 to 3. A good one to memorize. I memorized it in the King James. But I want to read it to you from the New American Standard. God, after He spoke long ago to the fathers and the prophets in many portions and in many ways, in these last days has spoken to us in His Son, whom He appointed heir of all things, through whom also He made the world. And He is the radiance, the Son, of His glory, and the exact representation of His nature, and upholds all things by the word of His power. When He had made purification of sins, He sat down at the right hand of the Majesty on high. Now, remember what our major point is, God's sovereignty. Another way of saying that is God's priority. Therefore, you and I should be careful and deeply grateful. What if God had never told us about Himself? There are things you need to know about God. You need to be warned about God. He's dangerous. Oh, see, I never thought of Him as dangerous. He's dangerous. When Moses approached the burning bush, God said, "Whoa! Take off your shoes." Now, what if he hadn't whoa'd? He would have gone up with the bush. When God made the tabernacle, He enclosed Himself in an inner room. That was His private room. And He put fences around His property. He put two sets of curtains between Him and anybody else. And then He laid down rules whereby you could come in and see Him once a year. And then you had to come according to protocol. Now that comes under the category of the fear of God. You and I need to walk with a kind of redeemed boldness, but we also need to walk with a fear, because this is very subjective and you have to receive it, but one night I had a dream. It was a long time ago and it's still very vivid. And it was an apocalyptic dream. Suddenly the heavens were stirred and I saw a theophany. I saw a presence of God coming toward me. And I said, "Oh, God is coming." And I remember I flung myself to the ground, and I buried my head in the dirt, and I said, I can't stand this presence. This is all in a matter of split seconds. And the next thought came to me, he's not only all awful, he is merciful. And I raised my head and worshiped. Now, my first impact was understandable. He's somebody to be afraid of. And that underlining, Paul says, knowing the terror of the Lord, we beseech men. Now, you talk to a lot of charismatics. They have no place for terror. They have no place for fear. God is a glorified Santa Claus. He's good old Uncle Sam up there, dishing out whatever you want. Two Cadillacs in every grass, two chickens in every pot. There needs to be a restoration of the fear of God because he's got priority. I think his satirical word to Job is delightful. Job 38, 1 to 7. You know, God's the best at everything he does. When it comes to satire, nobody does it better than God does it. Listen to this. This has got Shakespeare beat 27 ways to everywhere. Then the Lord answered Job out of the whirlwind and said, who is this that darkens counsels by words without knowledge? You know, we'd say, who's mouthy now? Now gird up your loins like a man, and I will ask you. And you instruct me. Can you imagine God appearing here this morning and saying, any people want to tell me that I don't know? Isn't it amazing? You say, well, in that kind of an existential situation, I'm sure we'd sit down. But when God isn't here, we do that. I said, now, God, if I were you, I would. God goes on. Where were you when I laid the foundation of the earth? You know, speak up, big shot. Tell me, if you have understanding, who set its measurements, since you know? Of course, what he really means is you don't know. Or who stretched the line on it? Who laid its cornerstone when the morning stars sang together and all the gods, sons of God, shouted for joy? Now, what did that leave Job? That left Job just a puddle. Job says, okay, God. But it's such a delightful piece of satire. You see what God did? God didn't fuss with Job and Job's level. God brought Job up to the reality of who he was talking to and the situation that he was in. And whatever Job was going through, God was sovereign. And don't you forget it. Now, there's three areas where God is sovereign. He's sovereign in creation. He's sovereign in organization, and he's sovereign in maintenance. He created, he organized, and he maintains. Now he's done that with you. You're the subject. You're breathing right now. What keeps you breathing? Well, after you've given me all the anatomical answers, the real answer is, if you are an agnostic, you're not sure, but some strange something or other keeps you going. If you're a Christian, you say, my breath is in his hand. God keeps me breathing. That's pretty sovereign, isn't it? You could take all the vitamins, do all the push-ups, be looked as healthy as an ox, and God says, I'm going to turn off his life support system. He's sovereign. The Lord giveth, the Lord takes away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. Now, a lot of charismatic people would laugh at that. Oh, God's. No, God is that. He giveth, He taketh away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. God is not going to reveal Himself to smart alecks. In fact, God is liable to give them a spirit of delusion, make asses out of themselves. There is a humble recognition of God's sovereignty that causes you to abhor yourself with sackcloth and ashes. Now, I say that in certain charismatic circles, and they rule me out as a heretic because they don't have any understanding of God's sovereignty. They're all taken up with His gifts, and they ignore the giver. That's why I said to you, get to know God's revelation of Himself so that you've got a well-balanced anatomical view of the nature of God. You know God's anatomy. Okay? Because He's the one with whom we have to do. Now there's frustration in that. Because when God is talking about what He's like as God, and you're a finite creature, you're not going to absolutely understand Him, but the Holy Spirit is going to give you enough understanding that you're going to walk humbly and in fear of Him while receiving His gifts with thanksgiving. What I'm looking for is the tension, the balance, not the extreme. I don't want you to go around expecting a thunderbolt to hit you back of the left ear. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm just saying have a proper mingling of fear and boldness. Walk in the tensions of truth. I wish I'd known that 60 years ago. Took me a long time to find it out. That all truth is held in tension. I was thrilled the other day to hear a man whose scholarship is a million miles beyond mine say the very same thing, and it comforted me. All right, God is sovereign in creation, He's sovereign in organization, and He's sovereign in maintenance. And in essence, folks, listen, in essence, what we are saying as we go around the country preaching the gospel to sinners is what Isaiah said and what Paul quoted in Romans. Isaiah 52:7, quoted in Romans 10:15. How lovely on the mountains are the feet of Him who brings good news, who announces peace and brings good news of happiness, who announces salvation and says to Zion, what does He say? Your God reigns. What is He saying? God is sovereign. All hail God. Hallelujah. So the gospel of the garden, like the gospel of the land, like the gospel of the kingdom, must have its roots in God's sovereignty. I'm not preaching something I created. I'm making declaration of something that has come out of the sovereign intention of God. I better find out what God's got in His mind, because that's what I'm supposed to be preaching. That's why I must preach the Word. That's God's mind. All right? The second thing in the Gospel of the Garden is man's distinctives. Man's distinctives stand over against God's sovereignty. Man is different because God made him and he's created. He's not self-existent. Now, let's deal with one question first. How do we know all about how Adam came into being and so on? Well, you don't have to be spooky about it. It's very straightforward. God told it, because God's a communicator. I'm sure when Adam said, "How did you make me?" God told it. No great mystery about that. Scholars love mystery because it gives them an aura of superiority. Any donkey can talk about mystery. The thing is to understand what is revealed. Now, the first thing is that man is distinct from the animal. Boy, is that up for grabs today. You see how important our gospel is. When we're talking to a man, we're not talking to an educated monkey. We're talking to an ignorant image of God. Sometimes they're not far apart. But we must make the distinction. The animals in Genesis 1:24 were after their kind. Their kind. God made all kinds of creatures. You've got to understand the fixity of species. When you crossbreed species, you get hybrids. A man is desperately trying to crossbreed. He's trying to destroy the male-female world. He tries to upgrade types of creatures, understandably. Nothing wrong with that. But he's got to understand that if he crossbreeds, he's going to produce a hybrid that in turn cannot produce. Because God has established a fixity. Now, what he can do is refine by crossbreeding within a kind. So you get all kinds. I saw last night a documentary where they crossbred dogs. Now, you can do a lot of crossbreeding within a species, but that's part of the creature's rational ruling over the animal. But even where we have rule over the animals, we can't violate the law of species. Oh, I know. I was thinking about Ruth and I were watching a documentary on the husky dogs. Any of you see that? Extremely interesting thing. And it told how that it crossbred this special kind of husky with wolves, which is within the species, to produce the kind of a husky dog that would endure the entire trek across the polar region. And those dogs were magnificent creatures, just magnificent. The men who were with them said that they could not have lived without them. Now there you've got a legitimate interdependence between the superior man and the inferior animal. And that's why we have to have a healthy respect for all of creation, because it was given to support us. When the Bible wants to talk about strength, it doesn't talk about man. It talks about a horse. Because in the Old Testament days, the horse was the most powerful thing they had. Whenever they want to talk about cannons and atom bombs, they talk about horses. Horses were their atom bombs. Horses were their cannons. Horses were their strength. Animals after their kind. Man, Genesis 1:26, let us make man after our image. Now these are the distinctives that make our gospel. We don't preach the gospel to cows. We don't go out and preach the gospel to gophers. You smile. But if you believe that we were all animals, why distinguish? Why not go to the zoo and hold an evangelistic meeting? Sure, your laughter's understandable. But your laughter wouldn't be accepted in some circles of educated idiocy. You would be scorned for putting down our brothers. And nobody has a love for animals more than I do, and a respect for them, that I recognize them as a species. If I don't close this, I'll be a species. All right, let me just read you this. The entire world is a revelation of God, a mirror of His virtues and perfections. Every creature is in his own way and according to his own measure, an embodiment of a divine thought. But among all creatures, only man is the image of God, the highest and richest revelation of God, and therefore head and crown of the entire creation. Keep your category straight, and you won't get into trouble. Must be time to quit my speaking things given up. All right? We'll see you in the morning, God willing.
This has been another of the many teaching cassettes by Aaron Baxter.